that Segundo here, and I'm very sorry about the two-week absence. You see, Jorge, concerned for my health, suggested that I take up rollerblading. Not having tried this before, and being coaxed to attempt this athletic activity with a small bottle of Cuervo, I gladly took up the challenge. You see, Jorge figured I might salivate like a Russian terrier. He was right. While casting my eye upon a rather large-breasted soccer bomb, I ended up colliding into a brick wall, and I was out of commission for a week and a half. The doctors tell me that I'm quite lucky, although let me assure you that there are great opportunities for breast watching while you're trying to seek healthcare in the hospital. The nurses, as it turned out, had better cleavage than the soccer mom who caused my personal contretemps, and I stuck around hoping that I could get the nurses to stick one of those thermometers in a particularly sensitive place. The doctors then asked me to leave. I refused. If I was going to pay hundreds of dollars for this kind of nonsense, I may as well get my money's worth, the way so many other men do on Hollywood Boulevard. Well, I won't go into the details, but suffice it to say there was a wrongful arrest, something that I apparently share in common with this week's guest, Tommy Chong.
So I am here with Tommy Chong, who has a book here called The Eye Chong, and I believe was half a member of some comedy. It was Hopin Crosby, I think?
No, what's his name? Chi. Yeah.
Chi.
No, Chi. Chi, something like that. Chi and Chong.
Gotcha. Well, he's here because he has this book, and we were actually looking over the statute here, which is Title 21,
yeah. Section a little late, 863. Yeah. 2 years after my sentence, my 9 months in jail, I'm reading what they call drug paraphernalia. Mm-hmm. Means any equipment, product, or material of any kind which is primarily intended or designed to use manufacturing, compounding, converting, concealing, producing, blah, 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 injecting, ingesting, inhaling.
But you observe something interesting, and that is the inconsistent spelling of marijuana.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's spelled M-A-R-I-H-U-A-N-A, and sometimes it's spelled with a J, which,
yeah.
Okay, that's an acceptable spelling, but we're this marijuana, it's like, you know, are we back in, like, you know, the 50s here?
Or? Yeah, 30s, actually.
38.
Yes. M-A-H. Marijuana.
Yeah.
Juana. That actually gives you an idea why, you know, people say to me, why is it illegal? And there it is. It's a racist law. Always has been.
Mm, yeah.
You know, it was designed to stop Mexicans, mm-hmm. you know, from enjoying their pot.
The odd thing,
white women. You
know. Well, the odd thing too is that this law came to being in the '80s, though.
Yeah,
yeah, which is remarkable that they're using this sort of spelling.
It was Nixon who did it? It was Clinton.
Well, Clinton did do this, but this particular.
I mean, he was in power then, wasn't he?
Well. Maybe. This particular section, though, that you were convicted under was actually, it came into being under the Reagan drug war era,
sure.
I found. And yet you also sort of pillory against the current Bush administration. I guess I wanted to sort of point out, well, why single out the Bush administration when there's sort of this ongoing history of incarceration and false incarceration and pedantic incarceration for drug paraphernalia.
But if you look at the history, it's always the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever they're in power, they're pandering for the right-wing Christian, you know, people. And so far, the right-wing Christian idiots, they still consider anything other than, I guess anything evil. Mm. Anything that... It's like a diet, you know. Anything that tastes good is bad for you, mm-hmm. and anything that feels good is wrong for you, as far as these right-wing Republican types go.
Sure. Well, there's also the issue of salsa dancing, which you raise in your book. Apparently, maybe you can talk about this, well, because this was apparently not greeted upon with the same kind of bonhomie as you know.
The judge did not think that my approach was very unique in any way. I don't know what he thought. He was a Quaker, so he probably thought that it was a salsa dance and was a code word for shooting heroin or something, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but The truth is, I really found that you can't get high and dance salsa. It's impossible.
You mentioned you have personal experience to back this up, but you failed to actually note specifically the incident in question.
Oh, in the book.
In the book, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I when I learned salsa, I went on a cruise. Is that the incident? On the cruise ship, and I took a little smoke with me, you know, just in case, you know, I'd learn and I'd have a little reason to celebrate. Well, I never learned. I just danced and danced and danced, trying to learn the dance. And when I got back to port, I realized I had still had the pot with me, and I had to smuggle it back into America. Mm. It was interesting, but thank goodness the lady was a fan, and she didn't search my bag.
Well, here's a question going back to the issue we were raising about like how there's this long legacy since the 30s, of course,
yeah,
of criminalizing and going after people who smoke pot and putting it in the same kind of category as heroin.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? I mean, you probably are aware of this, but if you want to be an FBI special agent, to actually go through the selection process, you have to, first of all, you can't have smoked pot in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
And if you've smoked pot for like 15 times in your life, you're disqualified.
Yeah.
How they can determine this by, like, you know, sticking prongs in you, I don't know. But I guess they will probably do sort of, I guess, investigation on you.
It's really a form of an aptitude test, mm-hmm. you know, because I really believe, and they probably know, that if you've smoked too much pot or done any kind of acid, that you are not susceptible to mind control. Mm-hmm. You know, that in other words, you can't swallow the rhetoric that is needed to swallow in order to become a DEA agent or an FBI agent, mm-hmm. you know, because we're talking puppet and robots here.
Sure.
You know, we're not talking, you know, people, you know, that have a free will. You know, you're talking, it's mind control, mm-hmm. total mind control, much like the Scientologists, you know, and I imagine there's probably a fair amount of FBI agents are Scientologists, you know.
Really? We'll have to actually look into this, I guess.
It's a mind control issue. And it's like the Army. Mm-hmm. See, before, remember, they would drug, they didn't want any kind of hippies in the Army. But what they found out, you know, the Army in America means cannon fodder. Mm-hmm. You know, people that are going to die for their country. Mm-hmm. So they really don't care who dies for their country. So they're look at, they put that one guy in that had a criminal record that ended up murdering and raping that Iraqi woman.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't care. The Army doesn't care. You know, they want killers in the Army. And it's the whole thing about the FBI and you know, their drug policy. It's Hitler's secret service, the SS. You know, they were elite, and that's what America is shooting for, too.
Well, then how do you go ahead, I guess, and circumvent the process when you're dealing with a situation where, okay, you've got this base of people who are fans of the Cheech and Chong movies and who have seen your career and who have actually, you know, you were at the correctional facility, apparently the second, the man who got the second most letters next to Michael Milken, which
yeah.
I was surprised to hear that. But,
yeah.
Given that there is obviously some sort of sentiment here that sort of views such laws as wrong, I mean, why do you think that they've been allowed to stick? It can't just be simple mind control.
I was only doing my job.
Mm-hmm.
I was only following orders.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole thing. Hey, when they execute people, they say, hey, nothing personal.
Yeah.
And then they kill them.
Yeah.
You know, same thing. You know, it's the same thing. I mean, I was in prison.
Yeah.
And the prosecutor, you know, after they sentenced me, she tried to be nice to me and say, well, you know, I heard they have some nice halfway houses. In other words, maybe you can get into a halfway house earlier.
Well, let's talk about this trial, because I actually was curious about the details, which I didn't quite get in the book because you were a little ambiguous about them. But essentially, the claim you make is that I'm not sure who it was, the judge or the prosecutor who offered you a deal and said that, you know, look, if you take our deal, we won't actually go after your wife and your son.
Yeah.
On what charges? On aiding and abetting or what?
My son?
Yeah.
No, what they would do. See, the federal government, when they get an indictment against you, what they do, first of all, they do it backwards.
Mm-hmm.
See, back in the day, for instance, when when the Constitution was formed, and you know, back in, for instance, the grand jury system. Now, the grand jury system was originally designed to protect the accused. Mm-hmm. It wasn't designed to help the prosecution. In fact, the prosecution was barred from any grand jury proceedings, because the grand jury would take the charges against the person, and they would meet, they would go over the charges, and they would decide whether or not the prosecution had a case. And if they never had a case, they would throw it out. They said, no, that's not happening. Well, over the years, the prosecution have thwarted the law, where now it's a tool of the prosecution. Mm-hmm. So everything from the grand jury to the judge to everybody is on the side of the prosecution, you know, and even the judges, they took away the power of the judges to be discretionary in their sentencing. Mm-hmm. At one time, the prosecution could prove their case, or at least find a guilty thing, and then the judge could remedy any wrongdoing by giving, say, a person like me, either dismissing the charges or giving me probation or give me, you know, they had a wide range of way they could act. They could be judges. Well, over time, you know, the political system and, you know, have reworked it so that the judges have guidelines that they have to follow. They're mandated to follow. That's why you have these mandatory sentencing. And that's why you could pick up a kid for smoking a joint if it's a second or a third offense. He could conceivably be sentenced as a habitual criminal and be sentenced to life in jail without possibility of parole.
Yeah,
I mean, you have that thing, and so what happens with the federal government now? The federal government is no longer has any checks and balances, and so they can, when they come after me, they just wanted me, and they went through that charade of the bongs, you know, just to have one federal law that I broke.
Yeah.
Now they can make me a felon and put me in jail and take me off the thing. And the way to make sure that I will plead guilty, because if I went to court, if I went to trial, with my popularity, I would have made a laughing stock out of their case. I would have had the jury laughing. I would have had the judge. I would have gotten everybody. But they couldn't take that chance. And so what they did, they threatened my son, who probably in all cases would have gone to jail, and my wife, same thing.
By threaten, what do you mean? Did they actually?
They threatened to go after them with indictments.
What kind of indictments, though?
My son owned the company, so they would go after him for conspiring to send the bong across the state line.
So this exact same thing as aiding and abetting, then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because in aiding and abetting, what happens is that they treat an aider and abettor as a principal, so they would give the same charges as you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And my wife, because she signed a check, they would go after her as being a co-conspirator.
Sure. Or co-signatory,
and then they would go after me, and even though I would say probably be found innocent, they would, you know, I couldn't take that chance.
So you entered a plea of guilty in order to reduce your own sentence, and I mean,
No, not to reduce my sentence. I entered a plea of guilty, taking a chance that I would be sentenced to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Because they never promised me that I would get off. They just said, you know, no one's gone to jail so far.
Yeah.
And so then I said, okay. And I entered a plea guilty to protect my son and my. The only deal we made was that they would not go after my son or my wife.
Huh.
And that was the deal.
The prosecutors made this deal with you?
Yes. I guess. I imagine. You know, my lawyers, and I wasn't there. My lawyers went and had a meeting with the federal prosecutors.
Really? Really? So it seems to me that given all of this stuff, you really almost didn't have any say, because your attorney was essentially running the show and trying to get you sort of out of this predicament.
Well, I had all the say in the world, but, you know, it was like pick a card and they would give me one card.
Yeah.
You know.
Gotcha.
I mean, yeah, we can fight it, Tom, but it's going to cost you a lot of money. You'll probably lose, and your wife and your kid and yourself will all go to jail.
Well, there was also this interesting issue you raised during the course of the book of the celebrity makeover of some kind, of doing many good deeds.
Well, that was a way for the lawyers to sort of earn their money.
Yeah.
Because what they did, they asked for a $100,000 cashier's check, non-refundable. Then they told me, well, you better plead guilty. So I said, well, you know, how, can I get some money back? And they said, well, no, we can't do that. But here's what we will do. We will show them what a nice guy you are. And so when the sentencing comes, we will tell the judge, you know, that you did this, you did that. You know, for instance, if you make an anti-pot commercial, that would help. If you taught kids, which I did, you know, that would help. And you get letters from people, you know. Well, the truth is, nothing helped. Mm-hmm. I was destined for jail, and they gave me right in between. They could have given me 2 years, mm-hmm. but they gave me 9 months.
Gotcha.
And
I noticed that in the statute, apparently they say that the max is 3 years, as I recall. Yeah, so they give you as much as 3 years with this particular statute. So
well,
since you shaved off about 2 years and 3 months off of it.
Is that conspiring?
Oh, because, so you had multiple counts then?
No, I had one count of conspiring to send paraphernalia across the state line.
That's this. So you had one count of this particular statute.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So that's what happened.
Okay. Well, then let's talk about this jail time. Certainly, I suppose you had an advantage in the sense that a lot of the population of the prison actually already knew you and knew of your films.
Probably
and,
all everybody.
Yeah. In fact, I wanted to ask you because there's a picture in your book of this guy. This bodyguard, Samoan guy.
Big Ben,
yeah. And he didn't actually make it into the book. I was wondering why that is.
Well, I didn't put too many people in there because I didn't want to make their time in jail any more uncomfortable.
Okay.
You see, the rule in jail is to disappear, mm-hmm. become invisible. Because if you become visible, then your subject, especially Ben, you know.
Yeah.
He's had his brushes with the authorities, and so, you know, I know Ben wanted to be mentioned. Everybody wanted to be mentioned, but I couldn't do it. I know the system too well.
You know?
And these people, the federal. First of all, all the federal prisons, as far as I know, are privately owned. Mm-hmm. You know, they're owned by corporations in from Denmark or somewhere. And there's also rumors, I don't know how true it is, that the Bush family owns the concession for the clothes and the shoes and everything else that are sold to the inmates.
Well, not only that, but if you put, there's actually a really good book by, I want to say, Joseph Hallinan called Going Up the River, I believe is the name of the book. And in this book, he actually notes how whole city economies or town economies are based off of the prisons.
Oh, and, sure.
You know,
sure,
it's remarkable.
The town of Taft, for sure.
Yeah.
Where I was at Taft, you know, there's guards and, you know, it's the industry. It's an industry.
Yeah.
A prison industry. And I got to say, in some respects, it's working, you know. It's working because a lot of people get educated, and a lot of people, you know, get medical attention, mm-hmm. and a lot of people, say get off, you know, their bad habits, their drugs, and everything else. And so in one respect, it is working, but it's a sad legacy, I think, that America has come to this, so the land of the free has come to become the land of the big brother.
Well, here's the question, though. In terms of actually entering prison, this must have been a tremendous transition for you. But I guess the question I have is, again, you had this advantage of having a sort of a built-in fan base, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you had, fame, you had, notoriety. You were something of a kind of countercultural figure from the 70s. These were advantages that someone else who was running possibly an equivalent sort of, you know, bong interstate shipping operation wouldn't have.
Well, the that's true, except there nobody else in the bong industry went to jail. I was the only one.
Yeah.
You know, so the bong people are the ones that are in business and still in business and back in business. Mostly got house arrest, a fine. They had their equipment taken away on them, you know. But I was the only one that did any jail time.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of that, you know, because it shows you that, that they thought I was a big enough threat that I had to go to jail.
Do you think, though, that it allowed you to get a sort of proper perspective of what prison life is like?
Or? Yes. Yeah, it's all good. I never had really one negative thing. I learned humility. I learned how to be humble. I learned my spiritual self, you know, rose to the occasion. You know, I really took advantage of it. You know, and I think the fact that I never did it, you know, I never really did anything criminal, you know, really helped me, because then I was like more of a martyr. I was more like Nelson Mandela than I was, you know, Johnny Depp's character in Blow, you know.
Yeah. Well, the question, too, is I guess I bring this up because, like, let's say someone was arrested for a similar charge, and who's to say that there won't be future versions of Operation Pipe Dreams, you know? Who's to say that there won't be future kinds of, like, you know, throwing people into jail for, you know, selling things across state lines?
Well, the thing is, though, they can throw you in jail, but they still have to give you a trial.
Yeah.
And you still have to, and it's a community standards thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a correctional facility serving a sentence is what I mean to
say. No, but they have to find the guy guilty first.
Yeah.
You see, so, see, what they did with me, they blackmailed me. You know, they hijacked me, they blackmailed me. I had to plead guilty, or else he would have went after my kids. But you get people in you know, that are dealing, say, on the fringe. You know, they're protected. They protect themselves, you know. Like the porn industry, for instance, you know. Remember that all that hoopla about they're going after the porn industry? I haven't heard anything. Have you heard anything about it?
No. Particularly not in California, you know.
No, you haven't heard anything. And, you know, and the porn industry is alive and well. And what happened to Mary Beth? She was going to prosecute this guy, you know. Whatever happened to that? You know, sort of disappeared, didn't it?
Sure.
Well, because people, you know, because in America, we do have the right to counsel. We do have a right to fight, to meet our accusers in court. And if you're not like a sick drug addict that has a drug problem, you know, you can mount a defense. And people have, you know, like I say, in the porn industry, people have gone to court and spent millions of dollars on legal fees, but they've won.
But what if someone, though, who doesn't have the millions of dollars?
They go to jail.
Yeah.
They go to jail. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, though, I mean, again, it's going back to sort of my initial question of you look, someone else is going to go to jail. They're going to, you know, they're going to be sodomized. They're going to be, you know, go on, you know, beaten up. They're going to get, you know, gruffer treatment from the guards, perhaps.
Possibly.
I mean, you know, I mean, that's why I sort of asked the question of, like, whether your prison experience was a fair experience compared to...
Absolutely not. No, mine was unique.
Yeah.
I was a celebrity. I was a judge. Even the warden shook my hand and was in awe. He was said, "Oh yeah, you're our famous guy," and he shook my hand. And you know, and that's the warden in the main camp. You know, the camp supervisor used to leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
Him and his partner, but they'd walk up to me, and I'd be out in my. I had a little workshop out in the garden, and they would just walk by and leave me alone. And I was literally going against prison rules. In one sense, I had a knife and I was carving cooking utensils, you know, like chopsticks and that, which is totally against all their rules and that. But they let it slide because, see, what happens in prison, common sense is usually the rule of the day. You know, they allow convicts. They know they got to eat. They let them grow their own food. The rules say that you're not supposed to. The rules say that, yeah, you can grow the food, but you're supposed to throw it away or you're supposed to donate it. And they donate some, but some, you know, we actually use it to cook because the prison food is so bad. So what they do in the prison systems, they have a set of rules that they know you're breaking. And when they want to just step on your neck and grab you, they call you on it. Much like the bong business, you know.
Yeah.
They had that pot law, you know, that bong law was sitting there waiting for a moment when they could use it against a guy like me, you know.
Sure.
To shut me down for political reasons, to shut me down and shut me up. But it backfired on them.
Now, in prison, though, did you, since you had this sort of celebrity influence, were you able to sort of use it to kind of help other people, like, say, people who were getting picked on or bullied? Or
well, you got the wrong impression of camp.
Yeah.
You see, in camp, there's no picking on, there's no bullying, there's none of that. I mean, that's all Hollywood stuff, you know. And then you're watching, say, Folsom Prison, where you got overcrowding and you got a Mexican mafia and you got white supremacists and you got all these gangs in there. And that's slowly fading, by the way. But the prison I was in was called Camp and was surrounded by a chalk line. There was no fences. There was one locked door. And there was rules. And you had to obey the rules. And if you didn't obey the rules, you were taken across the field to the maximum security, where they would throw you in an isolated cell, and you would stay there, locked up 23 hours a day, 1 hour for exercise, and you would be fed your meals, brought your meals, and then you would be in a real prison. Mm-hmm. So what in the camp I was in, it was an honor system. First of all, you did not give anybody attitude. You weren't allowed to argue with each other. And if you talk, I've seen some arguments. Mm-hmm. They didn't last long, and they sure didn't. Maybe in one instance I missed it, but there was a fist fight that I missed, but I heard about it, you know. So you know, it's a fallacy, man. The guys I were in, they were like guys as old as 88 years old.
Yeah.
As young as maybe, I guess, 18 was the youngest. But they're all white-collar, pacifist, gentle. There were 8 doctors in there. Medicare fraud. There were real estate people that lied on their mortgage application. There were a lot of methamphetamine addicts and people that sold, you know, large amounts. There were Arabs. There were Moroccans. There were Syrians, Russians. A lot of ethnic people. A lot of black people. They're black rappers. There were black guys in there for supposedly dealing drugs out of the UPS cars, you know. But they were all nonviolent to a fault.
So in a nonviolent kind of prison, yeah. There was very obviously very little violence, very little sort of contention,
no violence.
Basically.
Huh? Yeah, no violence. Hmm. Arguments, maybe.
Yeah.
That's it.
The most that happened apparently was a fist fight that you observed.
Yeah,
that
lasted for a little bit, and then they threw him in the hole. Now I talked about an incident, you know, where a guy was doing his business in the shower.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was like the big deal.
Sure.
You know? But we all every one of us had camp counselors, and the counselor it was like being a Boy Scout camp or something. And ours was a woman, beautiful lady, Miss Strickland, and she. She would hold these meetings, and she would tell us, you know, if you're not cleaning up your space or whatever, she would tell you, but in a sweet way. She was a very sweet, gentle lady, and for the most part, everybody in there. There were a few guards that were, you know, hard ass, you know, kind of mean, but for the most part, man, they were like old people. The guards were old, you know. One time they had a drill. It was very funny. They had a drill, and they had to put on gas masks, and then they had to do this riot march. If, you know, anybody comes, you know, they're like, boom, boom. You know, like the Watusi jungle, you know, where they're banging their shields on the ground. Well, these people were so old, man, they couldn't even hold their shields up. And it was sad, man. It was very funny.
You describe in this book, speaking of the guards, a number of the hazard pay scams that went on. Did you observe any of these personally, or were this?
Yeah.
Really?
No, I heard about them, and yeah. I seen a few things. I could see things. You know, I really don't want to go into it, but, you know, the other ones, you know, like the hazard pay, for instance, you know, getting everybody locked down.
Yeah.
That happens all the time. And what it's to give the guards a break too, by the way, because the guards, you know, when everybody's locked up, it's just like having a dog kennel,
yeah.
You know, and you got your dogs running around. Well, it's much easier when they're all locked up. You can feed them, you can count them, you can do everything much easier when they're all behind their bars.
Yeah.
And so then when they're locked down, then they get double pay, hazard pay. That's why the prison guards are the most, the richest and the most powerful union in California.
There's one interesting thing. I noticed that you didn't actually name, like, your prison number in this book. That you have the guards constantly referring to you as Mr. Chong or that kind of thing. I'm curious why that was. Or is this just something that you wanted to kind of forget about? Or?
No, they never called me by my prison number.
Really?
Ever.
Huh.
That's more television and movie. No, they knew me by
Chong. Or maximum security.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really the distinction here.
Max, yeah. I mean, my number, 07798, 07768, 07798. 077. I forgot my number.
Oh, which, by a strange coincidence, is the some sort of coefficient to something else. I don't know.
420.
Yeah.
No, I. No, they call me Chong, I guess. Hey, Chong. Miss Strickland did anyway. Mm-hmm. Hey, Chong, how you doing?
Yeah. And your dog's called you Chong.
My dog, yeah. Hey, man. Tommy. He called me Tommy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I guess. But, you know, I was there on an expedition to learn myself. Yeah. Was to experience, but to learn, to watch, to see, to record, to... And you're right. I didn't put a lot of what I did learn in the book. But basically out of respect, you know, for the people. Like one time I did a hurricane relief in Oklahoma when we got hit by a hurricane. And they said, come on down, you know, you can see the hurricane, you know, because you're a celebrity, we can get you in the, you know, past the police lines and that. Yeah. And I went down there and I had my camera with me. But, you know, I couldn't record any of it. It was too personal, seeing people's personal effects blown all over the place, and, you know, hanging in trees and stuff like that. I had no morbid curiosity. I felt such sadness in my heart that people's lives had exploded like that, and there are people like picking through the ruins and that. And out of respect, I couldn't bring myself to record any of it, because what would I do with the recording? Go home and look at it and see how, and be reminded again how sad everything was. And so that's the way I am.
Not exactly a great popcorn experience, you know.
That's right.
Sit down there and pop open the pretzels or something.
Yeah, yeah. I would rather watch someone else's version of that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a good cameraman that way. And that's why I was in prison, too. You know, I heard these stories, but I didn't feel it was, except for some of the funny ones, I didn't feel it was, I had the right to tell someone else's story before they told their own, you know?
But I would argue, isn't good comedy or good narrative all about sort of exposing, you know, the utter truth of human foibles and
as much as you can without hurting people.
Yeah.
See, that was my concern. Mm-hmm. That's why I left a lot of stuff out, because, I mean, when you think about it, you go, you know, that's what you had to do in prison, by the way.
Yeah.
That's what I learned. I used to heckle when those guys played baseball, and we had our team was up, and I'd coach our team, and then when the other team came up, I'd heckle them. Well, then something inside me told me that wasn't right, because I was abusing my position. Mm-hmm. You know, icons aren't supposed to be mean to anybody.
But if you actually go ahead and expose someone or reveal them, you know, reveal someone's kind of, you know, catastrophes or lives, you don't necessarily have to go ahead and heckle them. You don't have to necessarily take the piss out of them or anything. You could still sort of present their lives truly as
that's
how they
true.
Are, you know?
That's true, but, you know.
Is a difficulty for you? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, I learned, like I said, I learned humility.
Yeah.
And being humble. I mean, it's not that easy, you know. It's not that easy. It's really denouncing your ego, you know. And that's very hard to do in this world. And, you know, and being out of jail, in jail, it was very easy, you know. Lose your ego, very easy.
Yeah.
You know, because you're reminded every day that you're a piece of crap and you don't mean nothing to anybody.
Yeah.
You know, you get paid 60 cents a day for working there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and what I did, I found my dignity.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't lose my dignity. I found it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I carried it with me when I got out, you know, and with the book. And there's a sense of being able to not say anything at certain times. There's such strength in being able to be quiet, mm-hmm. and it's a restraint for me. It's very hard.
Huh. Well, now, in terms of adapting, you know, outside, how did your dignity or your humility kind of transition? Because as you point out, there's a difference between inside the pen and out, you know, inside the joint rather.
I'm like a lot of prisoners that I met years and years ago, they would come out of jail and they would have this calmness about them. There's a quietness about them. Mm-hmm. I would see them sitting very quietly and doing things deliberately, like picking up a book and reading a book, putting the book down and looking out and see. What you do after you get out of prison, you see things and you appreciate things that you never saw before. Mm-hmm. For instance, sitting on this couch. Did you know the 9 months I was in jail, one of the most precious commodities anybody could have was a little portable cushion that made out of foam that you carried around with you. Mm-hmm. Because the chair, everything you sat on was hard. It was hard as rock. It was plastic and it was hard, uncomfortable. Yeah. Everywhere. You couldn't sit and watch television unless, you know, for a long time because your legs would go numb from the hardness. And so I'll walk into a room now and I'll look at a soft chair or a couch in a different light.
Sure.
I'll look at dishes on a plate, on a table, where it's real china and real silverware. Because when you're in jail, you eat off plastic with plastic. Mm-hmm. And guys have done that for years. Guys have done that for 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And then when they get out, you know, they're fascinated by looking at glass. Or just tasting a beer. You know, the beer, alcohol, everything was forbidden.
Yeah.
And then even when you're on probation, you know, sometimes you'd be tested for alcohol or smoke, in my case. And so these are freedoms that you don't know what they are until you lose them. Mm-hmm. And then when you get them back, it becomes... you see things. You see people. I hear people differently now. I listen to them. I can tell when they're lying now. Mm. I couldn't tell before because I was just waiting for them to shut up so I could tell them my story. But now when I listen to people, I look at them. I listen. I see them. Mm-hmm. And there's that's the biggest difference.
Do you think this will have an effect on any sort of future comedy projects that you pursue? I know you have the marijuana logs.
Well, I've been doing the marijuana logs, and I've been, I even if I don't mind saying so myself, I've been quite fabulous on them because I do my own monologue.
Yeah.
In fact, the other guys had to sort of adjust because I would get such response to my monologues that they had to bring their A game, you know,
yeah,
and bring it up. I made them bring it up a notch, you know, because I'll do, like I do in my stand-up act, I'll do some current stuff, you know. If I read something in the paper, I'll do it that night. And no, my comedy has improved, I would say, 50%. Mm-hmm. Better.
Well, what about, though, you know, going back to directing films or writing things? I mean,
yep.
I looked at your IMDb entry, and, you know, aside from, like, you know, going back to that 70s show, there's not much there. So
no.
What explains that?
Well, so when my wife and I hooked up to do comedy, I just concentrated all my energies into that.
Yeah.
It was a lifestyle that we both enjoy. And going out for a few days, you know, doing our bit, you know, selling T-shirts and stuff, and then coming home, you know, and we made our nut every month, and it was a very comfortable life. And I turned down a lot of television shows. I turned down Dharma and Greg. I turned down Nash Bridges, by the way. I was asked to do
a second
appearance to read. Yeah. No, to read for the original.
Really?
Yeah, they asked me. And I turned it down. I turned down quite a few shows, you know, just to audition. I turned them down. And the 70 shows, the only one I took because I liked the way, you know, I was portrayed in it. I never had any ambitions to be other than, to be anybody else other than Chong.
Yeah.
You see, after Cheech and I did the records and the movies, I felt we made such an impact in the entertainment world that we would always be either compared to what we did, you know, I mean, and if we didn't do as good, you know, we would be told, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's much like Arnold Schwarzenegger trying to do something other than the Terminator, You know, everything's compared to the Terminator, with Arnold in the acting world, and like Stallone and Rocky. Yeah. You know, everything was like Rambo was Rocky with a gun, for instance. You know, and once you get branded, you know what I mean? There's a double-edged sword there. Yeah, you're branded, but yeah, you're branded.
Yeah, but Cheech has gone on to do all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
And do perform a lot of character roles and go away from the Cheech persona.
Yeah.
I'm certainly that, you know, given that you, the two of you together were quite good, then you could probably do something similar to
no,
that.
No, but that's what I don't consider Cheech's his forays successful, even though he might. I think he had to give up too much. You know, he had to give up his Chicano thing to the point where he can't even do it anymore. His most popular thing, you know, and so he's really become known as Don Johnson's sidekick in Nash Bridges, Cheech Marin. I mean, but he still wears the Cheech and Chong like a title, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but he was in a film of a very good. An underrated indie film called Luminarias, in which he actually played up the Chicano heritage, you know, and he actually did it a very interesting scene because he's this, you know, I mean, anyway, not to go on about Cheech and everything, but he played this. It was an interesting scene because there was some, you know, there were two guys there, and like, you know, Cheech was there and he was just like had this beer that he was guzzling and everything, and like, you know, and then the sort of the Caucasian in this was just like thinking that, oh, he was just like some, you know, little, you know, some typical sort of like Hispanic kind of punk ass kind of, you know, stereotype, but as it turns out, he turns out to be this professor, and so and Cheech played it very interestingly, so I don't think he completely abdicated his thing, and I guess what I'm sort of suggesting is that, you know, there's probably more to you likewise to do a sort of spin off of the Chong persona as opposed
but there again, you know, it's your choice.
Yeah,
you know, if Cheech wants to do that, that's his choice, you know.
Sure.
So he's welcome to it, you know, but it's my choice not to.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I've appeared in a few things, you know, just for kicks or for a favor, you know, but I have no interest in being working on a character other than the character that I created, the Chong character, you know, because like for instance, Up in Smoke, I wrote Up in Smoke. I basically directed Up in Smoke, even though Lou Adler took credit for it. And I directed all the movies,
yeah.
You see. So I feel I've accomplished more by doing what I did, because I touched on, like in Up in Smoke, for instance, it's an iconic movie where it plays probably now as much as it ever played before, you know what I mean? It hasn't lost anything, okay? Now that's my contribution, okay? In Up in Smoke, for instance, we touched on the immigration problem that is happening right now. We touched on the prejudice type things and the pot things, the war on drugs.
Yeah.
We touched on all that. That was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It's still irrelevant today as it was 30 years ago. So what I did, I created what someone would call a perfect movie, because it was done for less than $1 million, and it's still being played today, and it still defines Cheech and Chong, you
sure.
see? Now, Cheech as an actor, well, great, you know, because he is an actor.
Yeah.
So do his acting thing.
But
great.
You're an actor too, though. That's what I'm saying.
But I'm more of a director, more of a writer,
okay.
and more of a real person. I'm not a kind of guy that needs to hide behind a character or to have someone else's words. You know, I can do it, but it's not what I like to do.
Okay.
You see, that's all it is.
Well,
it's a matter of choice.
I'm just wondering, though, it's like creatively, since you're describing this change in perception, the way that you can read people's faces, the way that you can listen to their respective words and sort of, you know, sense things in an entirely different way. I mean, this would seem to be very advantageous in a way to sort of, I guess, you know, be either an actor or to do something
else. But why? I mean, why would I want to change? Why would I want to fix what's not broken? You know, I mean, Cheech is an actor.
Yeah.
So he acts. That's what he does. He acts.
Yeah.
I'm a writer. I write. That's what I do. I write. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if I found, if you find a persona in a character that works, why would I want to change it? Why would John Wayne want to change? He tried. Wayne tried. He's a good actor.
Yeah.
He tried to do straight roles, and he wasn't bad. But he was known for that one guy. So my thing is that I respect people, you know, the audience, that they don't have a lot of time for everybody, you know. I mean, certain people do, like you, for instance. You know, you follow Cheech's career, and you see, you know, his talent and everything else, and that's like, oh, that's great, you know. But the majority of the audience, the people that pay money, the people that buy our records, the people that come and see me at the signing tonight.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't let them down. I would never let them down. You know, they expect me to be funny. I'll be funny. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I'll do, I want to leave people with something more than just dazzle them with my ability to become somebody else. That's all I'm saying.
Well, also, you know, you have a story to tell about the prison system.
Yes.
And
yes.
About false incarceration. Yes. So how does this tie into, I guess, staying into, you know...
Well, that's my character. They put me in jail because of my character.
Yeah.
It all ties in. I'm such a good actor that they believed my character. The police... And I mean, the federal prosecutors, they saw Up in Smoke for a lot deep. They saw what I was saying about them. Mm-hmm. They saw exactly where I was going, and I was exposing their hypocrisy. And so they found it necessary to shut me down. If I was just an actor, they wouldn't even bother with me. But I'm more than an actor. I'm a spokesperson. I'm a leader. I'm a someone that they're worried enough about they put me in jail.
Well, let's talk about the difference between Chong the persona and Chong the man that is here right now. There's actually a quote I found of yours in which you basically declared. Hang on. Oh, yes. So basically, here it is. So you said, if you smoke pot, eat well, and work out, I guarantee you'll live forever. So a statement like that, does this fit in with both Chong the man and Chong the persona?
Absolutely.
Or I mean, where are the similarities and the comparisons? Where do you draw the sort of, is there sort of some sort of veneer that one can sort of hopscotch, like the Berlin Wall of Chong, so to speak?
Well, no, there isn't. There isn't. Yeah. You know, the Chong, the character, and Chong, the actor, or the you know, there's a very. It depends. Like if I'm playing Anthony Stoner, mm-hmm. by the way, that was the name of the character in Up in Smoke, Anthony Stoner.
Yeah.
Now Anthony Stoner, of course, he's a fictional character. He's not, but there's aspects of me in that character. Mm-hmm. That's all. I mean, the essence is me, but I'm playing a son of a rich guy who hasn't worked, you know, and he plays drums and he drives a Volkswagen with a Rolls Royce grill.
Yeah,
that's Anthony. Okay, the guy that said if you smoke pot, work out, and eat well, you live to be right. Well, I'm not lying. That's a true fact. Wouldn't you say?
I don't know. But inevitably, we were talking earlier about like the predictability of human mortality, I think, before we even set the mics. And so, you know, there is an end to everything. One doesn't live forever.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. But, I mean, you take, what I should have said, compared to the guys that eat drinking enormous amounts of alcohol, eat poorly, mm-hmm. and worry.
Sure.
See, that's the difference, you see. What I'm saying about pot, as far as being good for you, is pot makes you laugh. Laughter is good. Laughter is healing, okay?
Sure.
Pot keeps you from drinking booze. If, you know, a lot of people, like I'm included, is if I'm smoking, I don't want to get drunk.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to spoil the high. Yeah. I mean, it's not for everybody, but But for me, that's what I'm saying. And that's, I was a little bit flippant when I said it, but I still mean it. Yeah. Because I've seen examples. I've seen guys like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's a committed pothead, play 7 years past his prime.
Yeah.
And still be in the most incredible physical shape of anybody his age and what he's gone through. You know, there's a lot of positive things about pot that the authorities fail to see, you know.
Sure. Well, there's actually one part of your career that no one really remembers, and that is that you played with Bobby Taylor in the Vancouvers.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to talk about it. In fact, you know, Does Your Mama Know About Me, which was sung by Diana Ross and a number of other people. I had no idea until I sort of started doing research that you had actually co-wrote that song.
Yeah, so yeah, I wrote the lyrics.
Yeah, well, so tell me about how some of this musical background kind of influences who you are right now, or is it something that you kind of just do as a kind of second string kind of thing?
No, it's a part of me. It's a part of me. It was a part of Cheech and Chong, by the way.
It was, of course.
It was a big part of Cheech and Chong. It made us the first rock and roll comedians.
Yeah.
And we're the first, and so far the only ones that I've ever heard of or seen that could command a rock crowd, as many as 30,000 people. Cheech and I have performed in front of 30,000 people as comedians.
Yeah.
You know, because of our musical backgrounds. So it's part of the Cheech and Chong, and it's all part of me. It's all part of me. The only difference between the Chong that played with Motown and the Chong that played with Cheech is that when I was with Motown, I never said a word.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was with Cheech, you couldn't shut me up.
Gotcha. Now, I also heard that a Broadway musical of Up in Smoke was in the works. Is that happening? Or?
Yes, I'm working on... Cheech is working on his version, and I'm working on my version.
Wait, so there's going to be two Up in Smokes?
We'll see, yeah. Yeah, I started my version first, and then Cheech read what I wrote and didn't like it.
Mm.
And said it was very childish, asinine, and you know, drugs and everything else, and he wasn't about to do it. He wants to do the Cheech and Chong story,
huh?
About before we became Cheech and Chong and who we were before, and that's his version. And he offered me quite a nice bundle of money, you know, although there was some, you know, the contract wasn't airtight by no means, mm-hmm. and there was no script. But I'm working on the musical, it's called Pipe Dreams, the musical, and it's about Up in Smoke.
It'll be like you're the Eric Idle. And
yeah, exactly.
Basically, that's
exactly
what you're going
for. That's, in fact, that's who inspired me.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Eric Idle. My oldest boy's girlfriend works for Eric Idle. She's his niece, and she was the one that really turned us on to Spamalot. And then I went and seen Spamalot when I was in New York, and I loved it. And I could see how Up in Smoke could be a fine musical.
Sure. Is there any hope of, you know, I'm sure you get this asked infinitely, and you'll probably get asked this many times today, but any hope of reconciliation between you and Cheech? Or what is the situation?
Well I tried, you know. I mean, I tried. We went to Aspen, and we were supposed to have a reunion in Aspen. And the first thing I said to Cheech is, let's do some of our old bits, you know. And he said, nah, I don't remember them. And then I said, well, there's one bit we could do where you don't even speak, you know. It's a Harry and Margaret bit, you know. And he said, oh, okay, we can do that. And I said, well, do you want me to get the wig and everything? And he goes, no, I'll get that. Well, then he showed up with no wig and no intentions of doing it. And he had no intentions of becoming the old Cheech.
Yeah.
And I've got no intentions of becoming Don Johnson.
Yeah.
So it was an impasse. And what he did, he said, I just want to sing a Chuck Berry song. You play guitar, I'll sing a song. That was the extent of our performing.
Yeah.
Well, I had performed with my wife for almost 14 years, you know. So I have an act. And so when we got up on the stage, Cheech sang his songs, and they sang Mexican Americans, and then I took over. I sang Beaners. I wrote lyrics to Beaners, and then I did another song about me and my old lady, and where I got lyrics about Cheech and Don Johnson, and they're not flattering lyrics. They're funny, but they're not flattering. And Cheech sort of wandered around the back of the stage. I couldn't see him, but he was very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And then I did some jokes, and then we walked up the stage, and Cheech, you know, just wouldn't talk to me. He just walked ahead, and then. There's agents there. They wanted to book a tour, a Cheech and Chong tour, and it was like not going to happen.
So Cheech has matured, and you remain the sort of, you know, giddy adolescent.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Thing is, when you mature, if you're a comedian, you know, it'd be like Jim Carrey maturing. You know.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, I don't know how interesting that would be. You know.
Or because Peter Sellers, for that matter. You know, the same thing. You know. Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
You can't imagine, you know, if he had not been a batshit insane, you know, he wouldn't have been nearly as interesting a performer, you know.
Well, that's your talent.
Yeah.
See, that's what I've been trying to say, you know. I mean, Cheech is a great actor, but I haven't seen anything that comes even close to the Cheech that was with me.
Mm.
I haven't seen anything. I mean, his comedic lines and all, Sister Mary Elephant, all the records, everything else, nothing comes close to the effect that he has on people. Look how many people, George Lopez, Rodriguez, the whole Chicano comedy community owe a debt to Cheech.
Yeah,
because Cheech was the one that opened those doors for them.
Yeah,
you know, all of a sudden, hey, man, you can be funny doing that kind of humor.
Yeah,
so that's what I'm saying. You know, that's what I'm saying. I have no interest in this new Cheech.
Mm.
You know, in fact, you know, even his art. You know, he's going around with his art collection.
Yeah, he's done a lot around here too.
Yeah, he does his art collection. Well, you know, the saddest thing is that he's an artist himself. He's a potter.
Yeah,
he studied with some of the great pottery guy in Canada. Forget his name, Drohanchuk, and Cheech went up there purposely to study with this guy because he heard about him, and Cheech worked with him for almost a couple of years, I think, and he learned how to throw these incredible pots and that, and so if Cheech was going around showing his pottery, I mean, I would be there. I would be by. I would be so, you know, thrilled with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, who else? Steve Martin's got an art collection that he shows once in a while, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I mean, maybe it's me, but I think because I was his director for so many years, you know, it's just sad. It's a very sad for me. To see, you know, what he's doing now.
Well,
you know?
People change, and maybe this is because he actually was the first Jeopardy celebrity champion. You know, maybe if we get you being the celebrity champion, we can sort of tie things up here. I don't know.
No, I could never do celebrity Jeopardy. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not that smart. You know, I'm not that well read. You know. No, Cheech's got a lot of talent. I mean, there's a lot of talent there, you know.
Yeah.
But, and he showed it to us. He showed it to us in Up in Smoke. But I don't know, man. I mean, to me, I don't know. You're right. Like Peter Sellers or like any of those guys, you know. Even Martin and Lewis, you know. I mean, a lot of people like Jerry Lewis after Dean Martin, but
Yeah,
I mean, he left me cold, you know.
Yeah. Although, interestingly enough, he became a very skillful director, Lewis.
Very good.
Yeah, I mean, he's for all of, you know.
I was good.
Yeah. Were you inspired as a director by Jerry Lewis? I'm just curious.
Probably subconsciously.
Yeah.
Subconsciously, you know, because you're inspired by who you've seen, and I've seen his stuff. I was never really a fan Jerry Lewis fan. I was more inspired by Terry Malick, you know, as a director.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a guy like Terry Malick to me. In fact, I even called him up when we did Up in Smoke. I called Terry Malick.
Really?
And I wanted him to direct Up in Smoke, and he was so sweet.
Yeah.
And he said to me, he says, you know what? He gave me an advice. He says, you direct it.
Huh.
He says, you have to direct it. It's your vision. He says, if you you wrote it, you have to direct it. Now, I don't know if he was just putting me off, you know, or but whatever. I don't think he was. I think he was sincere.
Yeah.
And I took him as sincere, and I took him to heart, and I did it. See, that's the other thing that really bothers me about Cheech, is that he gives me no credit. He gives me no credit for writing those movies. He gives me no credit for directing the movies, you know. And he tells me I made him do it. That's what he tells people. I made him do those movies.
Well, for Cheech and Chong's next movie, I mean, who was the person who decided? Did you both decide that you would be directing that second movie on the flush success of Up in Smoke? Or
basically, I just told everybody I was a director.
Yeah.
In everything, I directed the very first improv group we had. I directed all the records, and I directed Up in Smoke, like I said, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lou Adler, what has he done since, you know?
Yeah.
It was Up in Smoke, and that was it.
Yeah.
He did The Stains, Fabulous Stains, which is apparently a cult movie. But no, I was the one that physically wrote it and physically directed it. But Cheech does still, to this day, does not give me credit for that. Mm. You know, and that pissed me off when it came to the Cheech and Chong reunion thing.
Yeah.
Because he told me, or no, he didn't tell me, but he told my daughter, who was producing it, that he wanted to get a real director. He wanted to get a real writer,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's an insult, you know? It's a pure insult. And then the other way he insulted me is when he went on his own. He says, okay, he's going to do his own movie, you know?
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the credits written by Cheech and Chong, so all of a sudden, how can this be his own?
Mm-hmm.
The only answer to that is that these other movies weren't Cheech's movies, they were my movies.
Mm.
And now he wanted to do his movie, and his movie did not include a part for me, mm-hmm. which was Born in East L.A.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the only movie, and he insulted me again. He had a cameo part for me. He wanted me to appear in a little cameo role. I mean, it'd be like Laurel and Hardy or Warren Martin and Lewis saying, listen, I'm doing a movie by myself. Dean, I want you to come in as a cameo, you know?
But isn't it not unlike, for example, like, you know, when some sort of like Tom York, for example, just put out a solo album, and he's with Radiohead, and he invited some of the Radiohead people to contribute on the album, although he went a totally different direction. I mean, you know, but he wanted to, like, pursue a different sort of artistic direction.
Maybe. And that will kill Radiohead,
hmm.
basically. It'll kill it, just like The Doors, just like all these other guys, you know. It kills it, man. Because the thing is, when the ego overtakes you like that, you know, when you feel compelled to have your own voice, that's the end of the group. That's the end of the Beatles. That's what happened to the Beatles. You know, see, even if you contribute just the beat, like Ringo did, that's just as important as all the lyrics and all the front stuff. Because if you just contribute the tambourine sound, whatever it is, it's a feel,
mm-hmm.
and that's why groups should be groups. You know, that's what I love about the Stones. You know, the Stones, even though Bill Wyman left and is another bass player filled his thing, Mick Jagger was smart enough to know that the Stones consist of the Stones,
mm-hmm.
and that it was very, very, oh man, it took a lot before they could get someone else in there to play bass. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when these guys start thinking that their mates, you know, that have contributed their soul, that all of a sudden they're just a drummer and not even as good a drummer as this drummer, you know. And I've been in groups, so I know what I'm talking about, man. I know exactly what I'm talking about. That's what happened with the Vancouvers. That's why we broke up.
Yeah.
Because the minute we got one record, Bobby Taylor's ego went through the roof, and all of a sudden they hired backup musicians to do the rest of the thing.
Yeah.
And then he started singing Smokey Robinson songs. And next thing you know, I mean, I'm backing up Chris Clark, you know, for Berry Gordy, you know, and not writing songs or nothing, you know. So that's when I left, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But no. And the thing is, man, when you have a partner or when you're in a group, everybody, it's like a rope. You know, every strand is important. And if you take away one strand, that weakens the rest of the rope. And if you take away four strands and there's one little strand left, okay. And then he has to get four new strands. You know, it's not going to be as good. You can't hire feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many drummers around, you know, that they record great and they're like for hire, like hookers, you know. Sure. Okay, he's in my band. You know, I know one drummer that plays for like four or five different bands, you know, because he's that good.
Yeah.
He's that sound, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you're lucky enough to get a sound, Wilson Phillips, for instance, you know.
Yeah.
They grabbed a sound that was so great, but because China was prettier than the other ones, let's put China solo and gone.
Yeah.
Once you break up Diana Ross and the Supremes, you know, the Supremes only did doo-wahs or whatever, but they were just as important as Diana Ross, and Diana Ross found that out.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well. Tommy Chong, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
And thanks for letting me vent.
Oh, hey, no problem. No problem.
Where do they go? Smoke rings I blow each night. Oh, where do they go? Those circles of blue and white. I wonder, why do they sing?